He's defeated every champion from every organization the sport of mixed martial arts has ever seen, and retired from the octagon as the biggest draw and the industry's highest paid athlete of all time. And now, Chael Sonnen's on PodcastOne.com. And for that, you're welcome.
Hello, stupid. I mean, my good friend. What is this I see in your... What is this in your hand?
This is a pencil of which I'm going to stab you in the thigh.
Well, the joke is on you, because I was referring to your other hand. What's this stack of papers? What do you got here?
Oh, nothing. Nothing.
You don't have any notes?
No. Where was I going to get a note at?
You have a stack of papers in one hand and a writing utensil in the other, and we're doing a show, and you're staring down at said papers. Wouldn't it be a reasonable conclusion to come to that those are notes? Oh, wow, you have a rectangle drawn on a piece of paper. Why did you bring that in here? And why are you staring at it?
You're funny.
You brought in a prop to a radio show?
We don't need notes today. We're going to tell stories. We're still in Vegas. So the first day, I'll take... You heard that we didn't have...
I think you were just about to say, I'll take responsibility. Then you changed your mind. Will you take some limited responsibility?
I will take full responsibility
for... That we were 659 hours early to check in?
Yeah, okay. So it's all my fault. That's fine. So we stay a night, and then we miss our flight yesterday. You're going to New York from here. I'm going to Chicago. So we're in Vegas. We're leaving right after the show.
We missed our flight. That's how you're going to choose to word. I'll let that go. That's fine. What do you want to do? You told me to turn the recording equipment on that you had a plan for a show. So take it over, Headmaster.
Headmaster, well, one of the things that the fans are always talking about is they love the old stories. So I'm going to go story for story. So I'm going to tell a story, then you're going to tell a story. First story is... how me and you became friends as adults. Matt Lindland was the number one rated
167
pounder in the United States in Greco-Roman for 4 or 5 years.
5 years.
5 years. And
I don't feel like this is your story if I have to keep chiming in. Are you prepared to tell the story or not?
Do you want to tell the story? You tell a great story. You do it.
Fine. Okay, it's your story. Okay, so we're not competing stories. We're just telling them. Fine. So this is yours. So Matt Lindland, number one wrestler in the country for 5 years. Won the U.S. Open 5 times. Made the world team. Now, boom, we're in Olympic year. And this is when this is for all the marbles. And he makes it to the final match. Now, he has to fly all over the world just to qualify the weight class. Very difficult to do. Somebody has to do it while all of your competition gets to stay at home and train just for you. So he's going around. He's qualifying the world. He's in Uzbekistan. I mean, he's not in great vacation spots. He's in places that are very hard to compete, but he gets the job done. He returns to the United States, goes out to Dallas, Texas for the Olympic trials, makes it into the finals against his nemesis, Keith Sarakian. Now, every year we talked about Matt being the number one wrestler in the country and all of that, and that was all true. But number two for every one of those years was Keith Sarakian. So Keith Sarakian and Matt meet up in the national final, or I apologize, in the final wrestle-off for the Olympic team. Now, the fans do need to understand for this story that the final wrestle-off is a 2 out of 3 match contest to be contested all in the same day, but it is the best of three. Now, they had just wrestled 6 weeks earlier at the U.S. Open, and Matt technical fouled him in the very first round. So, in some ways you look at this, there's a big gap between Matt Lindland and Keith Sarakian. The other way you look at it, Keith Sarakian is Matt's one and only competition, stopping him from getting to Sydney, where the Olympics were going to be held that summer. So, they meet up, and again, Matt had beat him every single time they wrestled for 5 straight years, had just beat him 6 weeks earlier in the very first round by technical fall, and Keith Sarakian beats Matt Lindland. Matt gets about a 3-hour break and comes back out for match number 2, and he beats Keith Sarakian. Gets about an hour break and comes back out for match number 3, and all hell breaks loose. And I watched that match. I was in the stands sitting next to my mother. Matt Lindland was on top. He snatched Soraki up, and Soraki hooked his leg as plain as day. And I turned to my mother. We're celebrating. We're cheering for Matt. I turned to my mom, and I celebrate because I know Matt's going to get 2 points and a caution. And 2 points and a caution, when you're as skilled of a wrestler as Matt Lindland, is going to win you that match no matter how much time's left. He could rest on that, control position, eat up the clock, and he is going to the Olympic Games. They finish the position, and not only did they not do a caution in two against Soraki and for Matt, Matt tried to finish the technique. Soraki comes out on top. He gets fully rewarded for it, and Matt gets nothing. Now, Soraki has the 2 points. Matt has 0 points, and I also know full well that Keith Soraki is good enough at controlling position, eating up clock, and this is the final wrestle-off, and us, meaning Matt, going to Sydney is not looking quite so good. It was a travesty, in my opinion. Now, I'm sharing my personal opinion, but that really did happen, where I turned to my mother because it was so blatantly obvious that, Keith had broke the rules of Greco-Roman, used his leg, which you cannot do, and was going to get called. It was absolutely blatant, in my opinion. Referees never called it, and this is the infamous match where, when time is winding down, they're now on their feet pummeling, and Matt Lindland just turns his head like Mike Tyson versus Evander Holyfield and bites Keith Soraki's ear. Now, I saw this happen. I've seen Matt do that move before. He did it to Jake Clark earlier that year in a freestyle match at Gill Coliseum in Corvallis, Oregon. But, you know, it's on a Jumbotron. This is the final wrestle-off for the Olympics in Dallas in a huge arena. They have a Jumbotron. So when Soraki yells and pulls away and the referees go to hold huddle up, somebody running the production replays the position on the Jumbotron. It's as plain as day, and then they zoom in on Soraki's ear, which has a very clear bite mark and a stream of blood running down it onto his face. The referees do not call it a bite. They say, hey, none of us saw it. We don't know what happened. Let this match continue. So they continue the match. Time's running out, and Soraki beats him 8-6. Now, Matt Lindland appealed that and said, wait a minute. A very clear rule was violated. I should have had 2 points and a caution. Instead, I got no points, no caution, and he got 2 points, and that changed the entire outcome of the match. Now, under the rules of USA Wrestling, too bad for Matt. He's done. When they roll the mats up that day and they award someone a winner, that is it. Your protest process is over. So Matt took it to a higher level. And that's where Matt teamed up with Steve Thompson, a very high power attorney out of Chicago. And it got moved to a higher level and a higher level and a new court and a new court. And it reached the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court and a federal judge decided they were going to re-wrestle that match. And that then got refused by USA Wrestling, who is the national governing body. And they said, no, Keith Soraki is our guy, and this is over. As a matter of fact, Keith Soraki is in, and he was somewhere in Europe, training for the Olympic Games. He's not even here to re-wrestle this match. Well, a federal judge, if there's anything he does not like, it is for his ruling to not be upheld. And that judge said once again, this match is going to be wrestled in Colorado Springs on Saturday at 9 a.m. And if Keith Soraki does not choose to show, that match will still be contested in Colorado Springs on Saturday at 9 a.m. And I am well aware of the forfeit clause. But that match is going to happen, and he brought the gavel down. So they put Keith Soraki on an airplane, fly him back. He's jet-lagged. He's overweight. All he has time to do is make weight. Walks onto the mat. And Matt Lindland did what he did to him at the National Open, which is he technical fouled him in the very first round. So Soraki's going, man, this is a mess. I never even should have been here. The people that, I don't know anything about this judge. I was never in a courtroom. I don't have an attorney. I know that USA Wrestling is my authoritative master, and they sent me over to Europe and told me that I am the Olympian. So then Keith Soraki goes into action to fight this, but a federal judge had already made a decision, and the ruling was carried out, meaning the match had been wrestled. But all of the things that had happened leading up to that, all of the backroom fighting, the fundraising, the PR, and all of that that needed to be done, a lot of people helped, but you and I were at the forefront of that. And, you know, it really does break my heart for Keith Soraki. It broke it at that time, but I swear to God, and I'm very good friends with Keith's brother, Aaron. I am objective, Aaron Soraki is not, and Aaron should not be. That is his flesh and blood that had an Olympic spot taken away from him, and I don't expect Aaron Soraki to ever say anything other than that was an injustice. But I will tell you, as an objective person, and even though I was cheering for Matt in full disclosure, Keith hooked his leg. And how that referee and the two other referees on that mat did not see that and do not call that is beyond me. And nothing happened to them, but the athletes were punished for it. And USAW says to this day, look, we've got guidelines, we've got procedures, we've got objections. All of those were exhausted, and to take it outside of us into a court, and they're unhappy about it. But ironically enough, Matt Lindland is now hired by USA Wrestling and is the highest-ranking Greco-Roman coach in America.
And a silver medalist.
Yeah, then he went on to the Olympic Games and got a silver medal. But it does hurt me for Keith Soraki that he did win the Olympic trials and he didn't get a go. But, you know, that's why I went to the courts. But that's what happened.
So, where was I at?
You know, thoughts are hard, man.
Thoughts are hard.
Remembering your place is hard. That's your story. I just told your story.
Okay, so now you're up.
Okay, so now I'm up for my story.
Yeah, Team Quest story.
I'll tie it into Team Quest.
The favorite story from the other night that I do remember was the Dan Henderson story, and I want you to tell that story.
Okay,
because I forgot it, and we should have used that yesterday.
Well, so here's the deal, and this is a bit of a tie into Team Quest story because it involves Dan Henderson, right? Dan and Randy start Team Quest. Dan Henderson story. So, you know, the guys that I look up to, Matt Lindland, Randy Couture, Dan Henderson. I talked to these guys before I fight. So I'm getting ready to fight Michael Bisping. And this is on Fox. This was the second time ever the UFC was on Fox. Huge opportunity. I mean, you want to talk about exposure. And our sport's in a different place right now. There's plenty of exposure. But back then, it was growing. But boy, Fox, wow. What an opportunity. So I'm going to fight Michael Bisping. And whoever wins is going to go on and fight for the world championship. So it's a meaningful fight. And it's on Fox. And it's a co-main event. And Dan Henderson, who I trained with for years, had already fought Michael Bisping. So who better to call than Dan Henderson? So I call him the day before the fight, and I simply ask him one question. And I ask him the same question before every time I have a fight. Can I beat this guy? And Dan responds, I think so. And I'm looking for more. Dan, you've fought the guy. You've trained with me. Break this down for me, right? Break this down for me. Put my mind at ease, because we've already weighed in. I mean, the fight's less than 24 hours away, but at this point, it is all mental. You're not physically going to get any better. Console me a little bit. Blow some sunshine up my ass. That's why I called. So he says, did you train? And I'm thinking, well, yes. Heavens, yes, I trained for the fight, but the fact that you asked me that is a direct admittance on your part that you've had contests that you have not trained for. And then he says, is it three or five rounds? It's like, Dan, we're both in the UFC. It's a 185-pound fight, which you happen to be in that division. And you know full well that the only fights that are five rounds are main events or championship fights. Now, Joel, this is the time that I was running around with a replica UFC belt over my shoulder and doing all these interviews and telling people I was the world champion. But I did think that Dan, who was in the division, knew that I wasn't, that it was Anderson Silva. So I had to say, no, Dan, I'm not the world champion. Anderson Silva is, and Rashad Evans and Phil Davis is the main event. I would have thought he knew. I would have thought he knew. He didn't know. So he says, you should be fine then. Go out there and, kick his ass. And I'm like, okay, you know, this just isn't what I was looking for in this call. And then I can hear him, like, kind of take the phone away, and then he's talking to somebody. Like, well, he's dealing something with his kids. So I could tell the kids had the attention, and I'm just bothering him. So he finally comes completely clean with the following question, which is, who are you fighting? So that's when he finally comes clean. Now, I should have connected the dots up until that point that he had no idea I was fighting tomorrow. He just happened to see my name pop up on the face of his phone and push the green button and said hello. But that's when I say Michael Bisping, and he's like, you'll kick his ass. Go right ahead. I'll make sure I watch. That's the entire story. But, you know, first off, he disclosed that there's been fights that he hasn't trained for. Second, he disclosed that apparently he thought either I was the champion or I was the headliner. And third off, he had no idea I was competing.
Okay. Here, I'll tell a story, Randy Couture story.
Why don't you just tell me the story and then I'll tell it for you? You want to give this one a shot? Take it, big kid.
All right.
Show us what you got.
I love you. You're my best friend. Why are you so mean to me?
So far, we're off to a bad start.
All right, listen. Randy Couture in the back bay of the dealership, when Team Quest just started, it might have been, I don't think it was even called Team Quest. It was just where Randy and Matt and Danny trained, and then Chael would come in when he wasn't wrestling. But Chael was still wrestling. When somebody new would come in, they would always have to go to with Randy Couture. Always. First one would have to go with Randy, and Randy would, you know, kind of show him what, put the pace on him, beat him up a little bit, and take the steam out of him. So, for instance, if the guy goes with me next, maybe the guy's not going to have enough steam to put it on old Joel. You know, Joel's running the car dealership. He's not a real fighter. So Randy would do that. So the other night, I'm sparring in your gym with Doria.
Yeah. He's a killer, by the way. It's not Doria, and I know his name. I've known him 5 years, but now you just said Doria, and now I'm stuck. But yeah, go on. Doria.
Okay,
Doria.
So we'll call him Doria. So Doria kicks my ass. I mean, he beats me up. I mean, he punches me in the face numerous times. I mean, he bloodies me up. He beats me up. And the only thing I'm thinking of is, Chael, you need to go whip his ass. Like, that's literally what you need to do. You need to go whip his ass. He just beat my ass. And you did it. And Randy would have.
Randy would have gone over there.
Randy would have went over there and put it on him.
So
absolutely.
But here was the God, I wish you wanted to call him Doria, because he listens to this show, and I've known him for 5 years, but you've thrown me off. So Doria... here's what you don't know about it. He's been gone. He's been gone for 3 years. That was your second practice. So it was the first time he'd ever seen you. Now, you look like a gorilla. You got, you know, what do you think you had on him? 100 pounds, 50 pounds? I mean, you were noticeably bigger. And you look like a killer. So he's sizing you up. He hadn't been in there. He doesn't know, you know, he doesn't know Eve from Adam when it comes to teammates in the gym. So yeah, things escalated a little bit. He didn't realize, hey, this is your second day. It was like his second day back after 3 years, and he's good. He's an athlete. Now, he is one of those guys, I'll tell you this, and he knows it full well, which is, he could be one of the, he's, thus far in his life, he's been one of those guys whose hard work has not matched his potential. And if he gets dedicated, keep an eye on that guy. But if he does not, he's going to be a practice room fighter. He's going to have a good round here, a good round there, but be too tired to put it together for 15 minutes.
Well, thanks for not getting my back, by the way.
With Doria. I think Doria is like a cartoon character. Oh, it's
Dory.
Dora, the Explorer.
Dora the Explorer.
All right.
We call him D. Anyway, he put it on me, and I was laughing. I was like, okay, somebody's going to go get his ass. Somebody's going to go get him for me now. No, I just got beat up.
Yeah.
I just sat down. Nobody had to pay the price. ORC would have took care of it. RC would have had my back. So, you, my friend, are...
But the point I'm trying to make is when Randy would go put a beating on somebody, it's because the guy was out of pocket. The guy would come in, he'd bully someone, he'd do something like that, so then Randy would grab him and wear him out. The guy just would have no lungs left. You know, Randy never hurt anybody, but he would push and pull on you and pin you down, and the round would be such a high pace, you know, with him on top of you and you pinned up against the fence and him doing mock elbows against you. Randy might have had to give this guy a pass too, because he saw what I saw, which is, hey, you're a brand new guy that's got 50 pounds on him. He has been off for 3 years, so essentially he's a brand new guy, and the situation was just misread.
Okay. So, I had an opportunity to go to the state wrestling tournament, watch my buddy John Walksmith kid wrestle a couple matches, watch some other matches, and they had the Hall of Fame banquet for Portland State athletes. There was six or seven, four or five football players. Travis West was being inducted, and so was Dan Mello. And I had a chance to talk with Mike Aluska. Do you know Mike?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So Mike said, Mike's a fan of the show. Mike's a fan of the podcast. He said he didn't get a chance to ask about your first professional fight. He said your first professional fight was in the state tournament your junior year against David Lee.
Yeah, you know, Haluska used to he used to punish a kid named Lonnie, who was on his team when Haluska was an assistant at Portland State before he took over the head job. If Lonnie had a match where he didn't get a flagrant misconduct call against him, Haluska punished him. Because, you know, Haluska was into the aggressive. Now, he didn't like to cross the line, but he liked his guys to go out there and wrestle tough and mean and beyond guys. And he had a guy named Lonnie. And when Lonnie would go out there and do that, good things would happen. But if Lonnie went out there and was scared or laid back, it didn't. So Haluska used to get on me. He'd pull me aside and tell me, Chael, you know, if you start wrestling in a bar fight, you're not going to do very well. If you're trying to score points in a bar fight, you're going to lose. And if you're trying to do a bar fight in a wrestling match, you're going to lose. A wrestling match, you need to wrestle. If you want to go bar fight, go out there. And he would tell me these things, but it's like, Mike, I'm essentially trained by you because you trained Matt Lindland. So I am a descendant of your philosophy, and I know your philosophy. So even though you're telling me this right now, I know the deal you got with Lonnie. I know the way you trained Matt Lindland. I know these things, but he would always pull me aside and say, hey, you're being too intense. You need to tone it down a little bit. And I was like, well, Haluska, I can see you watching. I'm doing this so I don't have to go do the sprints that Lonnie has to do.
So tell this. So the story is you're in the semifinals against Lee your junior year?
No, it was my junior year. It was the opening match. I drew Jim Coots. Jim Coots and I that summer, I ended up second in the country. He ended up fourth. So yeah, right there in state. We're the first match. Two top five guys in the whole country.
At 9:30 in the morning?
Because they wouldn't seed the son of a bitch. The way the OSAA used to seed, you only got a seed if you placed in that weight class the previous year. So you could be a champion from a down below weight class that moves up. You're not eligible for a seed. And then the only people they would separate is two district champions. Well, Coots got upset in his district, his first loss of the year. I won my district, so we weren't eligible to be separated. So I drew into Coots or Coots drew into me, however you want to look at it. And that would have been the championship match. I think you would agree. We end up in the semifinals of the national tournament. For sure, we're going to be the finals of the state tournament, right? At least by that math. So, no, we end up out there when you're wrestling Coots, and he's the one that started it. And Coots would admit it. I mean, Coots was a mean, ornery son of a bitch, and he only had one speed. He had one gear, and it was on. There was no off button, and he did not care about rules. He didn't care about any of that. He didn't care if he got thrown out of tournaments one match. He was coming out to punch you in the throat. And it was just those kind of matches. Every time we wrestled, it was as dirty and filthy as it could get. And, yeah, that's what happened. I put Coots on his back from our feet. Should have had two takedown and should have had near fall. I was counting in my head as I held him on his back. One, two, three, and I'm going, okay, boom, there's 4 points. I come out of that scramble, I have no points on the board. Referee deemed I had no control, didn't call a takedown. Until he calls a takedown, he can't call near fall. I remember that as plain as yesterday, and I was 17 years old, over half of my life ago. Apparently, I'm still mad about it. Haluska listens to the show. That's actually very flattering. I admire Mike Haluska, so that actually makes me feel good. I'm surprised that he's listening. What is he doing now, by the way?
I'm not sure.
But he still cares about wrestling.
Oh, he's
it's in his blood, man.
Yeah, he loves it.
You know, I met him when I was in the 7th grade. He doesn't know this. He doesn't remember me. But when I was in the 7th grade, he came out to my middle school. We had a dual meet, and he was the referee. And then he went on to coach the Clackamas program. Then he goes on to be a Division I head coach. Coaches a guy, Matt Lynn, who goes on and gets an Olympic silver medal. Haluska is a very meaningful part of Oregon history as far as wrestling goes.
Yeah, he used to drive me. Man, he would drive me all over the Northwest to go to freestyle tournaments.
Sure.
When I was still wrestling. He was a great guy. He is a great guy. The one thing I wanted to ask you was the year you fought, man, I want to say you fought six times. and you fought in more than one promotion. Do you remember what year I'm talking about?
Well, I had a few years like that. You know, I used to try to fight 10 times a year, but you had to find your own fights. You know, once the sport got a little bit more organized, then organizations would lock you down. And when they locked you down, that came with the contracts of, hey, we have to give you 3 fights a year. That's when you started getting really limited.
The Bodog's years.
Yeah.
How many?
Yeah, that was 2008. I got a bunch of fights with Bodog. I think I did 3 or 4 with them, and then they parlayed up with Sport Fight. Was able to do one there, and then I needed to go over to the WC to fight Paulo Filho and got that and another man. I don't know if it was 6 fights, but yeah, I remember the year.
Okay. So, one of the guys you fought was Amar Sulev, who was the number one ranked wrestler outside of the UFC at that time. Now, did you stop him, or did you beat him by decision?
Amar Sulev, I stopped him in the second round.
Now, up until your UFC career, was that your
that was my best performance. Best performance until I fought Yushin Okami was Amar Sulev. And not just because the reason he was ranked number 5 in the world, and I think I was honorable mention. They had like an honorable mention list for so guys wouldn't go throw themselves off bridges if they didn't make the top 10. They threw me in the honorable mention. He was number 5. He had just beat Bustamante, who was the UFC world champion. I was his very next fight.
And the reason I'm bringing up Bodog is because they were producing a show. Wasn't their fights for a show similar to what Bellator does with their fighting? They're at their live events, they are producing the show. They tell the audience, okay, we're going live, you're going to be seen on TV. They get people jumping up and down doing with the hope that they might be on TV for a half a second. Except Bodog didn't care. They didn't even have a crowd. They were doing it literally just for the fights and then the backstories.
Yeah, so I don't know if there was a question in there or not, but I'll speak on Bodog. I have great memories from Bodog. When Bodog came out, there was a guy named Calvin Ayer. Calvin Ayer was featured on the cover of Forbes magazine as one of the world's richest men. And nobody knew how many billions of dollars he was worth. And what had happened, he's a Canadian-born national, and he started a company that's a .com, right? Bodog.com. It was a gaming website. I don't think it's still around. I know Calvin's long gone. I don't think it's still around, but at any rate, so this is a worldwide business. Well, somebody came in, the Justice Department came in the U.S., and they said, hey, all these online gaming sites are illegal, and you need to shut them down, and anybody running them, we're going to arrest. And they gave them a deadline. You know, you have till tomorrow at midnight to take your oars out of the water and be done. And what the U.S. was upset about was that they weren't being paid their taxes. So the Justice Department teamed up with the IRS and told all of these owners, if you pay us our tax, including our back tax, nothing's going to happen to you. But that's the only way that it doesn't. So Calvin Ayer kind of went, well, hold on a second. I can't pay you your tax if you're telling me this is illegal, because it's illegal to pay tax on illegally earned money. So if you're telling me I can pay you tax, then you're telling me my business is not illegal. This is very conflicting to me, and I want to get some resolution on this. Well, everybody else, poker.net, I mean, every huge online gaming site there was, backed down, and they backed down instantly. Well, Calvin Ayer saw that as an opportunity, and there was only like 8 sites out there that anybody played on. 8 sites that control it. So when the other 7 said, yeah, we're out, Calvin Ayer went, well, now I can't. Because just by default, I just became the biggest fish in the pond. And sure enough, he was. Now, he could not come to the U.S., and they were seeking extradition, and they were trying to find him, and he had to hide out in Costa Rica or his home country of Canada. But the bottom line was, is his business went up, and he claimed that in football season specifically, he was making $8 million a day. That was profit. $8 million a day. And nobody really knew how much Calvin Ayer was worth. It was a mess. Even Forbes, who covered him and put him on the cover of their magazine, even said in there, we know this guy's worth a lot of billions, but we don't really know. He's a little bit like Pablo Escobar, where we really don't know that number. And Calvin couldn't have been a nicer guy. And he was a really big nerd. And that was the one thing that a lot of people didn't understand. He was a nerdy guy that created a computer program and then realized, hey, I could turn this program into a global company and just do gaming. And then he created this huge enterprise called Bodog. And where Bodog Fight had come around is Calvin had like $40 million marketing budget. So he goes, listen, I won't spend a single dollar on Bodog Fight. What I'll do is I'll just take $40 million or take X amount of money from my marketing budget and I'll create a show called Bodog Fight, but I'll just use that as a way to promote the website. I don't need to sell a single ticket. I can lose all sorts of money and it's still a wash. So that's why he got into it. So he's a very nice guy to work for. He couldn't have been easier because he didn't really care, you know, what happened either way. He was getting exposure. He bought, instead of buying a 30 second or a 60 second time buy on television, he would go buy in a 60 minute time buy, just like an ad space, but then he'd run his fights.
Didn't you fight a guy in a cage on the beach in some country?
It wasn't a cage, it was
a ring.
Hey man, we had some killers over there in Bodog. Ellenberger, Jake Ellenberger fought on that same card. Cain Velasquez fought for Bodog. I mean, I could go on and on. He had some killers over there. But, yeah, so they take us out to Costa Rica. And they made a lot of mistakes with Bodog because they spent a ton of money. So they took us to Costa Rica, and they filmed like 12 episodes all in one week. So we do like 4 or 5 days of fights of, you know, from 8 in the morning till 8 at night. I mean, guys are fighting all day. And they then would package those fights up, cut it up and editing it and make entire seasons. So nobody was there, but nobody could be there. They could not bring an audience in because they couldn't have these results revealed. That was their big plan. So we go to this private resort in Costa Rica where once you land in Costa Rica, you can't even drive or take a ship to this resort. You have to get in there by a small chartered airplane, totally private. And when we get there, they set up a ring on the beach with all the sound and all the lights. They go to great expense. Like, hey, man, you guys could have done this anywhere else, but this is where they elected to go. So we go out there, and the one thing they didn't take into consideration was the heat of Costa Rica's sun beating down on the tarp that was the canvas of the ring. So it is hotter than hell. I mean, you could fry an egg on it. And some guys make a deal with their opponent, we don't go in that part of the ring. And some other guys were like, to hell with that. I'm going to take the guy down and put his back right on that and burn his skin off, and I'll win the fight that way. It was brutal. They had to bring ice in before they could start a fight and spread the ice around the ring because guys couldn't step on the mat. It was frying their feet. It was that hot, and it was just an unforeseen. But when the cameras are set up and all the guys are there, and that plane's going to leave in a couple of days, and everybody's got to be done, and the shoot's got to be over, the show must go on.
So how do you warm up for a, how do you even prepare for a fight like
well,
that?
Well, mine was a mess. So I was told that I was going to fight at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was out there to fight Tim McKenzie, and we're going to fight at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm in bed, you know, on fight day, with nerves and everything else. I stay up really late and then I sleep in as much as I can. I don't eat a single bite. I've got my process. I show up, I do a nice long and slow warm up, I finish it with some sprints. I've got my process, is what I'm saying. So I'm going through my process and boom, 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 they're banging on my door. I'm sound asleep, they're banging on my door. Hey, you are up in 12 minutes. Everybody's over there waiting for you. Where have you been? I'm going, it's 11 a.m. I fight at 4 o'clock. They go, no, we changed that this morning. We thought you got the memo. It's like, I didn't get a memo because I'm asleep. So I just jumped up out of bed. And Robert wrapped my hands, and it was time to go. We didn't have time to warm up or anything. But again, you're on a time crunch, man. This is a show. You have to go when they call your name. And so I went out there, and I fought Tim, and that was the whole story. But, I mean, that's just the way it went.
This is the first time I ever heard the first time I've ever actually heard this story. So from the time you wake up to the time you're fighting, it's how long?
It definitely was not 20 minutes. But, I mean, I walked over to this event, and, I mean, I probably have got 100 yards. It's really close to where the rooms were. Robert wraps my hands, and they are yelling at us the entire time, and Robert's not cracking. You know, they're yelling, hey, we have a show to do, and you've got to go. And Robert's like, yeah, you got a show to do, and you know, I got the star of this particular segment. You're not going to do anything without him. That was Robert's day. Robert pushed back. You know, Robert's an alpha male. I've seen Robert puff up. It doesn't matter if you're a multi-million dollar company. Robert falls back his guy. But at any rate, once I was wrapped, man, I just had to grab the mouthpiece and go.
And you had a great performance.
Well, or he had a bad one. So poor Tim, I somehow ended up in a front headlock on our feet, and I hit an inside trip. And when he hits the ground, his rib went, something happened to his rib. When I inside tripped him, boom, he falls right to his butt, and I'm coming down on top of him. I'm hanging on his head. So there was something about that pressure and the pressure up from the mat. It separated his rib. So I rotated right into a Darce choke. I ended up having the fastest submission in MMA history, 11 seconds. But the truth was, it wasn't the choke. His rib had gone out when I tripped him. So all of this to do with Costa Rica and the plane out there, and I'm out there for a week, and you know the show and the 11 seconds. So yeah, man, that was pretty exciting for me, but I did feel bad for Tim. I mean, he was a perfectly nice guy. Now he's got a separated rib in a foreign country with no hospital around.
Okay, speaking of heat, were you at the dealership when Evan Tanner came back in the summer with full combat?
Yes. I watched that workout and thought, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
Okay, so the back of the dealership, the dealership's a tin box. So it's probably fair to say in the summertime, it's 115 degrees back there.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, that's probably
so
fair.
So you open the back doors just to get some kind of breeze. That probably doesn't help any because now the sun's beating in there. But you do your level best. So Evan Tanner came out. He lived at the dealership, lived in a van. Then he goes and fights Homer Moore. He wins. He then disappears for 2 or 3 months, 3 or 4 months.
Goes on a bender.
Wherever Evan went, comes back.
You know where Evan went. He went on a bender.
Comes. No one really knows where Evan went or what he was doing.
Bender.
There's really no way to know about. What do you think Evan was doing?
B-E-N-D-E-R.
Are you saying, do you think Evan Tanner went on a bender?
I have no idea.
Nobody knows. So Evan Tanner goes on a bender for 3 or 4 months, comes back in an old Jeep Willy. You know, he wanted a Jeep Willys, and they're a hard vehicle to find. He comes back in an old white Jeep Willys, and he has full combat gear. And this combat gear is, how would you explain that?
Yeah, so it was just that it was combat gear. It looked a lot like what a catcher would wear, like an in-between a catcher and SWAT team. So, you know, when a catcher drops down, that bat comes back, or that ball that's coming 100 miles an hour, he's got to be protected. It had that kind of a face mask, like a catcher would have. And then, yeah, I mean, it had the full chest protectors, but then it went all the way down the legs. Again, much like a catcher. I really think catcher gear is fair, except it was all black.
Sure.
You know, so these guys were blacked out.
It was Evan and Randy.
Evan and Randy, and this is Evan's idea, and Randy goes along with it. And I don't know if it's because Evan was new or because he was a badass or what the deal was, but Randy goes along with it. So they're in the back of that dealership in a million degrees with these outfits on, and the entire premise behind it for Evan is because you can go as hard as you possibly want. It's like, well, Evan, if you want to go as hard as you possibly want, there's a bag right over there. Just go hit the bag. And then the other problem with Evan, that son of a bitch, and I say this out of respect to him, but that son of a bitch, he went hard. He'd show up drunk half the time, and you ended up in a fight. I went with Evan Tanner more times and would leave bloody because that's how he went, or because he was drunk, or didn't know he was doing it, or whatever his excuse would be. But it's like, Evan, I don't need that. You need that catcher's gear on, man. Just go be you. You go pretty damn intense.
So Randy and Evan, they put that gear on. They fight for however long, 15, 20 minutes, whatever. I never, ever see anybody put that gear on again, ever.
They never did.
Okay, so that was the one and only.
I never saw that gear again. Not like Evan didn't even keep it in a bag in the corner. I never saw it again. But see, here's the thing with Randy. You know, we talked a little about this earlier. When you come to Randy with a stupid idea like this, but it's your idea, and you bring him in on it, you're going to finish your idea. And he's never going to call you stupid and tell you it's a bad idea. He's just going to make sure you finish it. So when Evan Tanner began to dehydrate and cramp up in that back room in the heat and want some water and realize he's got a goddamn mask over his face that's been latched on from the back, and the only person that can loosen the strap is Randy Couture, Randy didn't do it. And when Evan Tanner, 7 minutes in, realized I just lost 4 pounds of body fluids, and Randy Couture's on top of me, and I can barely move because I put on 50 pounds of body armor, Randy Couture didn't stop. And he just kept going, and he kept going. He kept, Randy never told him this was a stupid idea, and this is corny, and this weighs 50 pounds, and it stops our immobilization of our body. He didn't tell him anything. He just pushed him until he couldn't go anymore, and then he pushed him a little bit more, and then he pushed him a little bit more. And that's how Evan got the message, but that's how Randy delivered messages. That is what truly happened that day. Randy, when he was done, took it off. I was like, oh, what a great workout. And I knew it was a stupid workout. I watched the whole thing. I knew Randy hated it, even though he had a smile on his face. But Randy knew, I just broke Evan Tanner, and I'm never going to have to do this again. And there was nothing Randy Couture liked more than breaking another dude, even if it was in the back with no one watching.
Oh, man, that's funny. So one of the USA Auto was the name of the dealership. And all we had, 90% of our customers were Hispanic. And 90% of the employees was Hispanic. My detailer was Hispanic. My mechanic was Hispanic. All my salesmen were mechanics. And when we opened the back bay of the dealership to the gym, USA Wrestling gave Randy a Greco mat. And so we sent Poncho and somebody else up to get the mat. And they pick the mat up in Seattle, and they drive back to, they get pulled over in Tacoma, Washington. Randy's the heavyweight champion of the UFC, but that doesn't mean a whole lot to a lot of people. This is 2001, it might be 2002. That only means something to a few people. So Poncho's illegal. My detailer's with him. He's illegal. They don't have licenses. They don't have green cards. They have no business being here. And they have a mat from USA Wrestling in impound. So Randy had to go up there and get the mat out of impound. And they knew who he was. Thank God. He walked in. They were like, Randy Couture. He was like, these are my mats. These are my guys. Hey, let them go.
Pin me, pay me.
So the people there were the right people at the right time, and that's how those Greco mats got to the back of the dealership.
And speaking of dealerships, guys, go get yourself the TrueCar app right now. If you've got a smartphone and you're probably listening to this podcast on one, go into your search engine, type in TrueCar, and download it now. And guys, someday you're going to be looking for a car. And it doesn't matter if it's new or if it's only new to you. When you get ready to buy, forget about looking up the blue book. Forget about going through the paper and the different websites and trying to find vehicles and educate yourself on a car. Type in the kind of car you want. Year, make, model, year, color, the whole bit. Six disc, CD changer, whatever you want to do to that vehicle, type in your zip code, and it will show you what people in your area paid for that exact same car. At that point forward, you will be connected and work directly with a TrueCar certified dealer. Most people are saving almost $4,000 off of the MSRP, but what I love about it is it saves you time. When you get down to that dealership, you are ready to go. Do the paperwork, get the keys, pull away. Never waste time, get TrueCar, and do it today. Because again, whether you're looking now or in the future, at some point, you are going to need a car, and you will be glad that you can now bring transparency virtually through the internet and the car buying world. Get TrueCar now. Thank me later.
So far in 2017, Forbes and Podcast One have already launched three highly acclaimed shows. The Interview with Steve Bertone features the business world's most interesting names, like Adam Carolla, Twitter founder Sean Rad, and Hollywood's own Jessica Alba.
So I spent a lot of my childhood in hospital and hospital beds.
Under 30 with Steve Goldblum talks to the movers and shakers, like Nation Builder CEO Jim Gilliam and NFL Big Game winner Martellus Bennett.
Guys are afraid to be themselves because of their marketing deal.
And The List with Art of Charm's Jordan Harbinger.
We'll get behind-the-scenes insight and information that doesn't make the print cut.
Next up, Sports Money with Mike Ozanian talking to team owners, athletes, and industry leaders about the enterprise and money behind supreme athletic competition. Forbes on Podcast One. Not just entertaining, informative. Subscribe now at iTunes and don't forget to rate, review, and share. You're welcome. You're welcome with Jail Sonnen.
What? What? What is this, man?
What are you talking about?
You threw a pencil at me, and then you waved your hand, and now I've called you on it, and you said, what are you talking about? You've doodled more triangles onto the page. That's rectangles. That's for some odd reason, that's actually very funny.
That is really funny, actually.
Okay, I got to give you that one. That's actually really funny.
To stay on Randy, did you ever see Randy get beat in the back of the dealership by anybody ever?
I never seen him lose a round, but the closest I've ever seen was him and Henderson. Henderson, for some reason, and Henderson, it had been really weird his entire life about this. He's always done better with bigger guys. Always. He's the guy that moved up in weight and beat Fedor and beat Nogueira at heavyweight, that wins titles at 205 and at 185. He's a guy that likes size, likes that muscle, likes that little bit slower guy athletically. I have seen Henderson as close to getting draws and rounds as anybody, but no, I never seen him lose.
Where did Danny and Randy...
I watched Randy Couture drop a world championship to Rico Rodriguez. I watched Rico Rodriguez come in the back, and Randy kicked the you-know-what out of him. I watched Tim Sylvia, who was the heavyweight champion of the world at 6'8" and 300 pounds when he wasn't having to weigh in the day before, in the back of that dealership, and I watched Randy beat the heck out of him. So, no, to your question, I never seen Randy lose in a practice match.
When did... Danny and Randy, how did that relationship...
That all came through wrestling. And once again, Henderson likes to work out with guys and train with guys that are bigger than him. So they were separated by one weight class, but it was quite a bit of weight. Dan Henderson was the number one guy in the country. He was the Olympian at 180 and a half pounds, weight class that doesn't exist anymore, 180 and a half. Randy was the top guy at 198 pounds, again, a weight class that doesn't exist anymore. It's been moved to 211. But they were the two top guys separated by one weight, and they started training together. Randy moved to Oregon, and how he got Dan to do it, I don't know. Because Dan was in sunny California. You would think if anybody's going to pack up and move, it's going to be Randy. But no, Dan came out here.
So I asked Randy this. I'll ask you this. The UFC's blowing up a little bit. He's been the champ a couple times, and he moves to Vegas. I go watch you at the Mohican Sun Casino. And I go out there to see Randy, and he's in this closed, it's a bar, but they've closed it, and he's surrounded by cool people. You can tell they're cool because they really, really act cool.
So like a bunch of dorks to me.
There you go. But anyway, so I'm like, he's famous now. And he comes back, next time I see him, I see him in Bend, Sun River. And I'm like, hey, bro, when did you know this fame thing popped off? And he said he was in Japan for somebody's fight. Might have been one of your fights. I don't know. And he got absolutely mugged. For you, when did you get it? When did you go from signing a couple autographs, taking a couple pictures, to being a mob scene?
So I had... the first time I ever signed autographs was the weekend at the MGM that Randy fought Pedro Hizo, Matt fought Phil Baroni the second time, and Evan Tanner fought Homer Moore. I was signing autographs, and I was a corner man for Matt. And I thought, wow, these fans pay attention. I mean, if they know who a corner man is, my goodness. Well, I only later found out they thought I was Evan Tanner. And I don't ever have people tell me, hey, you look like Evan Tanner. But we did have on the same outfits. Remember those
sure.
outfits that we all had from the gym? And so I had that as a corner man. And I didn't. So anyway, that was the first time I signed autographs. And then that turns out to be terribly embarrassing. That was in like 2003 or 2004. And then it was many, many years separated. And I had fought... every time you fight and you either got a co-main event or a main event. And that was always my goal. I didn't care who the opponent or any, but I wanted to be co-main or main because now you get included in the countdown show. And all that media helps, man. If you can get a co-main spot, get included in the countdown show, and those did huge ratings back then. There wasn't much content on TV. This is, again, prior to the Fox deal, prior to ESPN having coverage. It was a totally different world, even though it was 2009. Some things started to change in that regard. But after I fought Anderson Silva the first time, I was in a... limousine. We were somewhere, well, we were in Las Vegas. We were going to the Magic Show, which is a huge clothing, like a convention. All these different vendors come out, they show off their clothing, all these buyers come. You know, that's how I met you know, that's how I met up with those guys at Tap Out. I was brought out to the Magic Show for Tap Out. So I was in a limousine with Pat Barry and John Fitch, and somebody else was in the car. And guys that had fought way more times than me, and the guys that I thought were big deals, and they were. And we pulled up, and there was this line of fans. And I remember saying something to Pat like, you know, have fun. I thought they were there for him. And Pat and Fitch both look at me and go, I think they're here for you. And I was like, really? And I got out of the car, and I was with these other killers that have been around a while, and they were right. They were there for me, and I lost that fight. But for some reason, like the exposure and the media that was behind it, that was really when that happened.
Were you given autographs, or now it's just pictures, right? I mean, how many times do you even sign an autograph now?
There's still autographs, there's still pictures, but I mean, this is in very rare places. If I want to be famous, I got to go to a fight. I don't get any of that walking around. You know, walking around my hometown or just in a normal setting. But that's all that's the power of television. If you get on TV, then I feel that. Whenever people say they don't get starstruck, I do, man. If you're on television and I meet you in a regular everyday setting, man, it's a cool thing for me. And I usually get let down. Most of those guys are pricks and I wished I hadn't met them. But I still do feel something when I see them. I go, oh, wow, that's the guy from such and such.
You know, I've made fun of fans before because I've had to watch it, you know, being with Randy, seeing how fans treat Randy, being with you, seeing how fans treat you. A couple days ago, you're at a craps table and the gentleman next to you sits there for about 45 minutes to an hour, doesn't say anything. We leave, comes up to you, says, hey, my name's Levi. I didn't think it was appropriate to talk to you there. I'm a big fan of yours. I was in Tim Kennedy's squad. I got blown up. I got hooked on pain pills. Lost everything. Got into real estate. Now I'm a multimillionaire. I have 30 employees and 80% of them are veterans. And I was like, in all the times I've met somebody that would tell a story, that was the coolest story, and I wanted to give Levi a shout out. I don't know if he listens to the show or not, but I thought that was really, really cool, and I made a note to speak on it in one of these podcasts.
Yeah, you know, that kind of stuff can really make your day. When somebody comes up and they tell you some story like that, man, that stuff really means, that's powerful. It also makes me a tiny bit uncomfortable when I meet a true hero, a guy that went over and served with Tim Kennedy, who is a hero, was blown up and injured, okay, and then he wants to put me over. And I'm always thinking, like, yeah, we do some fighting, and there's a lot of bells and whistles around us, but you guys are the fighters. I mean, you guys are the real fighters. I can't – remember we had Marcus Luttrell on, the lone survivor?
Yeah.
We couldn't even leave the studio that day. We did an hour podcast with him, and then you and I sat in that studio for an hour – as our bodies were having like this physical decompression of this story that he had just told us, this moving and powerful and heroic, courageous story. He was putting me over the whole time. And I'm going, Marcus, what are you talking about? You know, you're Marcus Luttrell, man. I went out into a cage. If I got in a spot I didn't like, I tapped my hand a few times. My tag team partner named Herb Dean comes in and bails me out of the situation. You're in a gunfight in a foreign country and you don't have enough shells to win. You're going to put me over? And I kind of had that same thing with Levi, where I'm going, Levi, I owe you a thank you, man. You don't owe me anything. So sometimes there is a little bit where, but you don't want to tell a guy that and be condescending. Then he leaves and goes, oh, he was unappreciative of my compliments. Like, no, man, I was appreciative of your compliments, but let me just set the score for you here. You are a fighter and a hero. I'm a guy that got an opportunity to do a sport. There's a big freaking difference.
A cage fight.
Cage fight.
That's what it is. Who is the toughest, the three toughest people to come through the back of the dealership that never really made it?
Well, I mean, we got guys like that right now. We got guys like that right now. Now, I think some of them are going to make it. Ricky Simone's going to get his shot. He's the best fighter I've ever seen. But I used to say he's one of the best fighters I've ever seen. He's the best fighter I've ever seen, including television. He can do everything Conor McGregor can do, and he can wrestle. and people are listening to this now going, who the hell's Ricky Simone? Well, remember I said that name. Tyson Jeffries was number one. Tyson Jeffries whipped everybody in the back. Somehow he got hooked up with Rampage. I think Dolce made that connection. He was so helpful that Rampage was paying him $750 a week to just come out and be a sparring partner, which meant he actually touched him about 5 minutes a day, about one round a day. And Tyson was winning those goes. Bisping then learned about him through Rampage. Bisping brought him in. Tyson was winning those goes. Bisping's the world champion. Rampage was the world champion. But boy, you bring the people in, turn the cameras on, and call it a competition. And Tyson was he struggled with some competitions, with actually going out and competing and performing. But as far as a practice room guy goes, anyone that's ever been in there with him would say Tyson was the guy. But as far as the three best guys, see, that was one of the things about Team Quest. And we just had so many people come through, from the BJ Penns to the Boss Rutens to the Don Fries to the James Thompsons to Rico Rodriguez to Tim Sylvia to, I mean, just keep on naming the list aside from the team. That's when you could really see who was who. And some of those matchups were never going to get made. And, you could only see them in the back. You could only see them when, Evan Tanner was the world champion. Champion of the world, had the belt. But I was in the back. I was in the back every day. I wasn't even in the organization. Chris Leben was in the back. Ed Herman was in the back. All in the same weight class. Nate Quarry was in the back. Same weight class. Matt Lindland was in the back and ranked number one in the world. Ranked number one, but Evan had the belt in the same weight class. And there was never a hostility between us or where I would try to go with Evan and go, see, ah, ha, ha, I'm the real champion. There was never any of that. We were always just really happy for Evan that he got the belt, and we're going to do whatever we could to make sure he kept it. But you still knew. Everybody still knew who was who. And everybody knew where everybody stood. And that is one of those things where you're in that kind of an atmosphere. And we still do. We got a great gym right now. And some guys are bigger stars or whatever. We all know, man. We all know Ricky Simone's the baddest dude in this gym. He just happens to weigh 135 pounds and hasn't got his opportunity.
The gentleman that I noticed last weekend,
Brent Primus, he's going to fight for the Bellator championship. He's been fighting for Bellator for title, but for a while. But he's going to fight for the world championship.
Boy, I tell you, it doesn't take too long to watch a guy in a practice room that is really, really good for you to say, "Oh, wow, that guy's really, really good." Now, some people can kick and punch and do some different things, but I watched him for 20 seconds, and I was like, that kid's the real deal. Where'd he come from?
Yeah, and he's strong, and he's got his jiu-jitsu, his little moves, but who doesn't, man? Who back there doesn't have a skill set and some strength? But Primus brings an intensity, and I bet that's what you noticed above everything. But you probably didn't look at him and go, wow, what a great jab, what a great cross. You notice the intensity. You notice he's right in a guy's face. He's pushing the whole time. If things are going his way, he's pushing. But if things are not going his way, he's pushing. And that is one thing about him. We talk about Jake and Ryan on here all the time because we see more of them than we do anyone else. We go spar with them privately too. But that's the thing about them. They are really good and all, but I could say about everybody.
Sure.
They have a different intensity. Sunshine won his fight over the weekend, by the way.
I seen that.
Yeah. Still undefeated.
Now, do you know if he gets the next fight? I know somebody was mad at him because he took a...
Yeah, the promoter was mad at him. I never fully understood that whole thing. It's like, and Sunshine was saying, hey, I got a deal with you. It's not exclusive. I'm going to go take this deal too, but I'll honor my deal. I know you think I'm going to get hurt and pull out, but I'm not. And he won this fight, and that fight's still on, and so he told his truth.
So I know the answer to this.
Make this your final question. And I love this. This is a lot of fun, but let's get out on this one. So anything you want to ask,
I'll let you run on this one.
Ask me your best question. Put it. That's all I'm trying to say.
Fan question: was Evan Tanner a genius or a maniac?
No. Look, here was the thing, and this gets really tough to talk about with Evan, and I think I'm one of the only guys that will actually do it, but I do it from a different mindset, and I'd like to lay that out first. We lost Evan Tanner. He died. When a guy dies, you don't say anything bad about him ever. Now, Evan Tanner was my friend, and he was my teammate, and I could tell you 100 great things about Evan Tanner, but to your specific question of was he a genius, this one I have to answer honestly. I can't cloak this one at all. Because what Evan did and the way that his life had ended, this is a lesson of what not to do. And I have seen so many people try to put a bow on this thing because of the respect. But look, we lost him, but some people really believe that he was a genius. Evan Tanner was alive in the time of MySpace. This was before Twitter existed and before Facebook had exploded, and MySpace was the biggest social media platform there was. Evan Tanner would go on two-week benders where he would not leave his house. He would not leave a couch except to use the bathroom. He wouldn't eat any food, and the only calories he consumed were hops and barley. For 2 weeks at a time, his body would diminish, he would shrink up, he was getting sick, but he would be on this computer till all hours of the night, and the people that were on that page would tell him how brilliant he was as he sat there, and they believed that he was philosophizing. He was not philosophizing. If you go back and you read those words, those were the ramblings of a drunk man. And the only reason that I speak so candidly about this, Joel, is from a level of responsibility. That nobody should read the rumblings of that drunk man. They didn't know that he was drunk. They didn't know that he was costing himself his life, that he was eating himself and his relationships and his money and his financial and his career away. They thought he was out speaking and like he was, you know, like he was some kind of a prophet. And he started to believe that. When that's all you're surrounded with is these kind of positive affirmations, you start to believe that stuff, and it can start to become a very scary place, and that's where Evan got. Evan, before he went out into the desert, Joel, had been on a several-week bender. His body was tearing down. He's turning down UFC fights from Joe Silva. Joe Silva couldn't even get a hold of him, and when he did, Evan wouldn't even ride him back. He wasn't in the gym. He hadn't broken a sweat. He's literally wasting away, and he puts out that he's going to go on his motorcycle so far into the desert that one mistake could cost him his life. Now, if anybody else had said that to a group of strangers on an internet, that would be what we call marketing. He wouldn't actually do it. Well, Evan actually did it, and these people on the internet that looked up to him encouraged him to do it. Now, they are not wrong to do so. This was their hero, but it was still make-believe land. They also didn't know that their hero was three sheets to the wind and had been that way for the last 25 days. So he gets on his motorcycle, he drives out into the desert and nowhere, he makes that one mistake, and it cost him his life. And if there's anything that we're going to learn, we're not going to put political correctness in front of this. We're going to tell people straight. Those were the ramblings of a drunk man, not of a wise prophet or a philosopher. And just like he predicted, it cost him his life. And those are just not the things that you want to follow. Now, Evan Tanner, Joel, I would put his work ethic when he was training against anybody I have ever met. I don't know anybody that can do more than two hard sessions a day. That's as far as you can go. Evan used to do three. He is the one and only person to this day that I've ever met. I know guys that have claimed to do three and four and five, and they're all liars. Evan Tanner actually did it. He worked extremely hard. He got extremely disciplined and extremely focused. And again, I could tell you a number of compliments about him, but as far as it comes, was he a philosopher or some kind of a genius? No. Those writings, and they are still out there, were done by a very, very intoxicated and sick man. And it cost him his life, sadly. But that's what happened.
Yeah, we'll have to tell some funny Evan Tanner stories sometime. I remember where I was when Evan died. I remember you calling me. I was in Billings, Montana. And we've got a bunch of great Evan Tanner stories we'll give you sometime. I've got to get to the airport, and I know you do too. So we've got to jump out of here, boss.
Yeah, hey man. You know, don't forget, this is still my show. I will bring people in. I will send people. I will determine when this show is over. Maybe that's what you should be putting on your notes of paper instead of rectangles. And you want to know how I do it when I have had enough? I tell everybody, until next time, I'm Chael Sonnen, and you are welcome.
Baby.
Thanks for listening to Your Welcome with Chael Sonnen. Download new episodes every week at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Hello there, you. It's me, Jay Moore. You know me from the Moore Stories podcast. I'm a comedian, I'm an actor, and I talk to people that fascinate me, like Brandon Boyd from Incubus, super funny Jim Jefferies, Jay Leno, Charlie Sheen, Lakers owner Jeannie Buss, and a whole lot more. Download a few episodes of Moore Stories now. Moore Stories podcast every Monday. Podcast One app, iTunes, podcastone.com.